I'd like to welcome as my guest a former crew member on a B-25 bomber that took off from a flight deck in April of 1942, whose mission it was to bomb Tokyo. And welcome, David Thatcher. Thanks for being with me today, Dave.
You're welcome.
David, think back. Go back in time here a little bit. And tell me a little bit about the training that you went through in order to develop the skills that you guys needed to be the first and only U.S. Army bomber crews to actually ever take off from an aircraft carrier. What got you ready for that?
Well, we're at Eglin Field, Florida, and they took all the weight out of the airplanes they possibly could. We would be flying without radio communication, so they took all the radio equipment out. They removed the bottom turret. We knew we'd be flying so low that no enemy fighter could get underneath of us. In the place of that turret, they put a 60-gallon leak-proof tank in there. They took all the oxygen equipment out because we wouldn't be needing any oxygen flying that low. They modified the planes in that way. They put over 100-gallon tank in the top of the bomb bay, and we still had room for 400 or 500-pound bombs. There is a crawlway between the back of the airplane and the front of the airplane, between the top of the bomb bay and the top of the airplane. Just a few feet you can crawl through there. They put a collapsible rubber tank in that area. And then after they used the gasoline out of that, I was able to roll that rubber tank to one side so that I could crawl up to the front of the airplane. I was the engineer gunner. We had the 250 caliber machine guns in a turret on top of the airplane, and the bombardier had a 50 caliber machine gun in the nose. They put in two wooden drumsticks in a tail and painted them black as sort of a deterrent in case an enemy fighter would come up behind us. The training we did there, we made normal takeoffs, and then they kept cutting the distance down until they could get off in around 400 feet, and they had all the weight out of the airplane they could get. And then they began to increase the weight until they were able to get off in that short distance with a full load of bombs and a full load of fuel.
Mm-hmm. Now, there were no catapults for...
No, there weren't any in World War II.
Oh, boy. So you didn't have any assistance. So that morning that you actually took off, you were up on the flight deck before you actually got in the airplane and launched, correct? And what was it like? Was it stormy? April in that north, far north, it must have been pretty cold.
Well, it wasn't so cold, but it was very strong wind blowing. So they headed the carrier into the wind, and with our speed, we had no trouble getting off. But before I got up, after I got up in the airplane, well, then they handed me another 12 5-gallon cans of gasoline. So we had all the gasoline aboard we could get aboard.
Now, they didn't plan for you to land back on the carrier. You would not have had enough fuel. Now,
there's no way to land on the carrier.
Right, and you wouldn't have had enough fuel to get back anyhow. Now, from what I read, you had planned a night flight.
Yes.
But a Japanese fishing boat or a small craft saw you and had enough time to radio back to Tokyo, they were afraid.
Yes.
So you had to change the go time, correct?
Yep. Yes, we had to take off as soon as we could.
Uh-huh. How much time did you have to get ready?
We were originally going to take off in the evening and bomb Japan at night, but we had to take off around 9 o'clock in the morning, so that put us over Japan right at noon.
But you had further to fly.
Yes, about 250 miles farther.
I don't know. How many gallons does it take to go 250 miles in those things?
I don't remember.
I don't blame you. It's hard to figure that out in the cars we drive. Astounding. So here you are. Nobody had ever taken off from an aircraft carrier before. They thought it would work, but did you have any doubts in your mind?
No, because when the Hornet was first built, but then they took two B-25s with very little fuel and no bomb load off the coast of Virginia and tried it, and they made it off all right. So
okay. How many planes were there that day?
16.
16. And how many? There were five-member crew, was it?
Yes, five in each crew.
And in addition, there was a pilot, a co-pilot, navigator, engineer, gunner, and then a...
bombardier.
A bombardier. And you had four... What, tell me about the bomb load again.
We had three 500-pound demolition bombs and one 500-pound incendiary cluster that would break apart when it dropped out of the airplane. It was made up of 126 individual ancestry bombs, and so it would was to start fires over the area after the demolition bombs had exploded.
Right. Now, some of the planes went to Tokyo, and some of them went to other targets. Is that correct?
13 went to Tokyo. The other cities they bombed was Nagoya, Kobe, and Osaka.
Mm-hmm.
One plane to each target.
Now, you were on a very famous plane. Tell me about that.
Well, when we were in training in Florida, was another crew member supposed to be on the crew, but he drew a picture of Donald Duck and sort of bandaged up with a couple of crutches just in shock and drove it on the airplane. And it wasn't long before the other crews come up with that name.
Now, hadn't he scraped a tail or something in the practice sessions, the pilot of your craft?
Several of the airplane did when they were practicing in Florida.
Uh-huh. So you may have been the first one, but some of the other planes had colorful names, too. Do you remember any of those?
Oh, let's see. Harry Carrier.
Harry Carrier, that's good.
Whiskey Pete.
Whiskey Pete. I see a couple other. Bat Out of Hell. And
yeah, that was one of them. Mm-hmm.
Fickle Finger of Fate, The Avenger. Amazing.
Not very many planes had names on them.
Oh. Now, you were 20 years old.
Yes.
And you were an enlisted man, and not many of the people on board were enlisted. Is that correct?
Well, less than half of them. About two-fifths of them were enlisted.
Hmm. And you were a corporal. You, after this mission, there were a lot of promotions, and you were promoted to sergeant.
Yes, everyone got a promotion.
And as I remember, Colonel Doolittle was afraid that this mission would be called a failure.
Yes, because he lost all the airplanes.
Right. Let's talk more about the flight. You took off at 9 in the morning, and what time were you over Tokyo?
Little afternoon.
Did you fly right near the ocean all the way to Tokyo?
Yes. We did not go in formation. We all went in alone.
Okay. And you weren't sighted? You say that there was no anti-aircraft fire or any... I think some fighters intercepted some of your planes, didn't they?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But not your plane. You were up in the turret gun. 50 caliber, but you saw nobody to exchange fire with.
No, the six of them that flew over top of us didn't. I didn't want to draw their attention.
Oh, no. I can see that. Now, what was your target, David? What were you looking?
Steel factory in Tokyo.
Okay. And did you had to take the bomb sites out of the planes, didn't you?
They took the Norden bomb sites out because they didn't want them to fall into enemy hands.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the pilots sort of invented a little aluminum bomb sight that cost about 20 cents. It worked much better than a Norden because Norden isn't very good at low altitude.
Mm-hmm. How high were you when you dropped? Did you drop all the bombs at one time?
Yes, in succession. We had to climb to 1,500 feet to drop the bombs so they wouldn't blow us out of the air when they exploded.
Right. Now, the plan was originally, how were you supposed to get out of Japan safely?
Get from Japan? Well, we were going to fly to China.
And when you had to take off early from a further distance, naturally that ate into some of your fuel supply.
Yes, but we thought we could make it all right.
Mm-hmm. Now, most of the planes did make it to China, or...
All of them but the one that went to Russia.
Okay. But now, some of the men were captured, were they not?
Yes.
And some of them were treated as war criminals.
Yes.
Okay. Now, did you strafe any of the targets, or did you fire your machine guns at targets on the way out of there?
No.
Okay.
As soon as we dropped our bombs, we just dived back down over Tokyo Harbor and went. And we followed the coast of Japan. We didn't fly over the water, but we could see the coast until we finally reached the southern tip of Japan and headed west to China.
Okay. You were supposed to land at an airfield, was it? What was the plan?
Yes, we were supposed to land at the air base at Chuchao.
Chuchao. And so they weren't prepared for you there? You just didn't have enough fuel to get there?
Well, we ran out of fuel anyhow, but a couple of planes did get over the city. But they had been told that we would arrive the next day, so they weren't prepared for us.
Oh, boy.
Some of the airplanes got over the city, but the Chinese thought they were Japanese planes, so they turned the lights out on the field.
Oh, boy.
So they had to bail out.
A little breakdown in communications there.
Well, something happened in China. There was an airplane to took off, and it was supposed to bring homing radio to Chuchao, but it crashed on takeoff and killed all aboard, so that they didn't get to the airport of Chuchao.
So you made it to the coast of China?
Yes.
And you were real low on fuel, and how did that work out? The pilot was forced into...
It was almost dark and raining, and he spotted a strip of beach, so he put the wheel down and thought he could land, but misjudged the distance in the dark, so we hit the water with the wheel down. That stopped us immediately and turned it over.
Oh, boy. Were you belted in, or...?
No.
Oh, geez, you... Must have been a ping pong ball inside that plane, bouncing around off stuff, or yeah. And there,
well, the pilot and co-pilot were strapped in their armor plated seats. So.
Okay, now, so you had to crash land, basically. Yeah, that wasn't his attempt, but you crash landed into the ocean within sight of the beach.
Yes.
So, what happened then?
Well, I was in the back of the plane. And I was knocked unconscious for a while and came to, sort of, and then I could see water coming in what I thought was the bottom of the airplane, and finally realized the airplane was upside down and the plexiglass on the turret had shattered, and that's where the water was coming in. So I was able to open the rear escape hatch on the bottom of the airplane and crawl out there. And then I walked back to the tail of the airplane on the bottom of it, and when I stepped off the tail, then the water was about waist deep. By that time, the rest of the crew were up on the beach. The pilot and co-pilot were still strapped to the armor-plated seats when they came to in the water. And they were all very seriously injured. I had a bump on the top of my head, but that was about all. I was in pretty good shape.
How about the other two men, the navigator and the bombardier?
They went out through,
Were they hurt badly, David?
Quite bad, yeah. The navigator was leaning between the armor-plated seats with his shoulders up against them, and he mislocated his shoulders, and the bombardier must have gone through the nose of the airplane head first because bracing on the plexiglass, nose is sort of indented at the top of his head, and he was bleeding profusely when I get up there.
Mm. Boy. David, let me reintroduce you for anybody that may have joined us late. I'm speaking to David Thatcher, who is a survivor of the Doolittle Raid against Tokyo in April of 1942, kind of in retaliation for the Pearl Harbor thing and something to try to turn around the nation. What would you call that? It was a propaganda move, David. What would you call that?
Well, it was a retaliation. It was also boost the morale of the Allies.
Yes, boosting the morale.
And it just did the opposite to the Japanese.
Well, I'm sure. Now, I read somewhere that at one of the planes or somebody could hear Radio Tokyo laughing about a report that they got. Did you hear that news too?
No.
Okay. Well, they.
I think aboard the carrier, they were listening to Tokyo Rose probably and picked that broadcast up.
Mm-hmm.
After we left.
And she laughed about the thought that we could actually strike Tokyo. Is that what you heard too, David?
Yes, something like that.
Astounding. I heard she went off the air a little later when the bombs started impacting.
Yeah.
It's anyhow, we last, before I brought your name up again for everybody listening, we were last talking about you on the beach after the crash landing. You had 4 seriously wounded fellow crewmen. You were on the beach, though. But did you have guns, or did you have anything to protect you?
No. Soon saw some people up on the bank there above us, and they must have heard the crash probably because they came down there from their houses they were in, and they first thing you want to know, they pointed to each of us, and then they pointed to a finger on their hand, and then they pointed to the airplane out there. By that, we understood they wanted to know if there was any more of us in the airplane.
Uh-huh.
Somehow or other, we convinced them that it was just the 5 of us.
Okay.
And then they helped us get up to where they were living in the houses. And I was the only one got out of the airplane with my pistol belt on. And I had a pretty good-sized bandage in the first aid kit. The pilot, Ted Lawson, had a deep gash in his left arm and in his left leg. And the co-pilot had a gash in his arm. And that's all I had then to bandage up the gash in Lawson's leg. And then all else we had was the handkerchiefs or some old dirty rag that the Chinese gave us to try to bandage them up.
Right, now, was this an island, or was this mainland China?
No, this is the island of Nantien, N-A-N-T-I-E-N, off the coast of China.
Okay.
It's a good-sized island.
Now, was there any Japanese occupation of that island, or was it all friendly?
Well, there were no Japanese on there at the time.
Okay.
So the Chinese underground helped us escape then.
And how did they do that?
Well, the next morning, during the night, I went out the airplane and tried to get to it, but the tide had come in, and I couldn't get to it. So then the next morning, about daylight, I went out, and it was washed high and dry. Then the engines and the propeller had been torn off, and they were quite a ways from the airplane. But I couldn't find any first aid kit. So then I went back to where the other fellows were, and a Chinese guerrilla leader on the island, he had some stretchers fixed up, sort of bamboo pallets, and the other 4 of the crew were in so badly injured they could not walk, so they had to be carried.
Mm-hmm.
So we left there about 11 in the morning and started to cross the island. Well, later we found out that a Japanese company had landed right at that spot and came looking for us, but we had a head start on them crossing the island, and they never caught up to us. So it took us all that night and most of the next day to get across the island. And then they had a sampan was a fair-sized boat with a cover over it. You couldn't stand up under it, but you could sit in underneath of it. So we were out of sight. And then that evening, before dark, we reached the city of Haiyu on the coast, and that was still free territory. So we stayed there overnight, and then the next day we traveled that same way by sedan chair and walking to the city of Linhai, and there was a hospital there, and a Chinese doctor and his son were doctors, and that's the first place we got to where we had an interpreter. There was a missionary from England and his wife were there at Linhai, so they could translate for us.
So it must have been comforting to be able to communicate with the people that were helping you.
Yes.
Now, the Japanese didn't like the fact that you were getting help. When they tried to track you guys down,
yes,
and find out which direction you went, they went to China first because that they did occupy parts of China. Is that correct?
Yes, they had been fighting. Chinese had been fighting Japan for 4 years.
And losing, right?
Well, they were doing pretty good.
Oh, they were? Okay.
Pretty good, yeah. The Chinese had blown up all the roads along the coast to slow the advance of the Japanese. So when we traveled, after we left in the hospital in Iowa, crew number 15 made a good water landing on an island out farther from the mainland than we were. And they were able to get the life raft out, and it floated for 8 minutes. The only medical doctor on the raid was on that crew. And he got everything out and got it in the life raft, but as they left the airplane, slid it off the wing, a sharp edge of one of the flaps had turned up, and it punctured half the raft and dumped everything in the water.
Mm-hmm.
But they were able to cling to the raft to get to shore. That crew caught up with us at the hospital 3 days after we got there.
And the Japanese were nowhere in sight, or were they still on your trail?
Well, they were sort of still chasing, yeah. But so then after 3 days, I went inland with that crew, and the Doc White, the medical doctor, stayed there at Linhai with my crew. So we traveled by sedan chair and walking for quite a few days. All had to walk was trails through the rice paddies.
And Japanese people were carrying the stretchers?
Chinese coolies.
Oh, Chinese coolies.
Yes.
Okay. Boy, what a story. Do you remember anything about that night? Do you still have the vivid images of everything that went down?
The airplane?
Everything, just the whole event, your escape. And when you look back at it, do you still see some images that have stuck with you all these years?
Pretty well, yeah.
Hmm. Now, how long was it? The flight was on April 18th, 1942, correct?
Yes.
When was it when you finally got to safety, to where you actually felt safe, that you knew they couldn't get you?
Well, when we got to the small city of Haiyu on the coast, that was free territory, so from then on it was fairly safe. We traveled about by every imaginable type of transportation you can think of. We finally got to a huge city on the Yangtze River, Hanyang, and we were to wait there for an airplane to come in and pick us up from Chongqing. Well, 3 days we were there, and every morning the air raid siren went off, and we would go down to the dock and get on a tug and go up the river a ways and get out on shore, and there was about a seven-story pagoda. on the top of a hill there, so we climbed up there and could look around, and we could hear the Japanese planes bomb the city and the airport. And then after they left, the Chinese with their baskets were able to fill the craters in the runway and have the runway ready for the next day. Well, the fourth day in the morning, an airplane did come in from Chongqing and to take us, to take us to Chongqing. Well, that day, the Japanese came over and bombed and strafed that pagoda. They had spies through there. They knew what they had been doing.
Well, they knew they were helping you. The Chinese people were helping you, and they retaliated very strongly, didn't they?
Yes. Any small town or village that we went through that the people had helped us, they wiped out the whole city, men, women, and children.
How many people did they kill, about?
Approximately 250,000.
It just seems impossible that they could do that.
They were so angry that they had helped us after us bombing their homeland.
Yeah, I can see where they were angry. It's just to kill that many people seems astounding to me. So you got an award for your acts that evening, that night of the bombing, and how you helped get your fellow crewmen to safety. The award was
all the men that were on the raid were awarded that Distinguished Flying Cross.
Mm-hmm. And I saw somewhere you got the Silver Star, though, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I guess it was from help to save the crew.
Okay. Well, what an honor. We've got about another minute. Time flies when you're having fun and lost in history here, but it's been an incredible time that we've spent together. I really appreciate it. What would you like to add to what we've already said, David? Oh, tell us about your ceremony, your reunions that you do.
Well, they've had a reunion every year except 2 years since 1945. And it's usually almost always around the 18th of April, the anniversary date. I've been able to go to about 40, over 40 of them through the years.
Where do they have them?
Some city bids on it a year ahead of time, and we decide.
How many went to the first reunion, do you remember?
I don't know. I didn't go until 10 years after the raid. That was the first one I went to in Miami Beach. But they've had them, quite a few of them in California and Texas and Florida. I don't know how, there's mostly in the western and the southern United States seems like they have them.
Okay, and the roles have just gradually shrunken since the war then?
Yes.
Okay, now there's one particular ceremony that I find pretty poignant. You do a roll call.
Yes, when they have the drink a toast to everyone has gone, where they, after reading the roll call, then they toast to all those who have gone. And if a raider who died the previous year, they turn his goblet upside down. Mm-hmm. They are in a case, and they have our names right side up, and also when it's upside down, that name is engraved on the goblet.
David, how many goblets did you have at the last ceremony?
There's five left then.
Last
year, yes.
Mm-hmm. And this coming reunion, how many goblets are there going to be?
Well, we'll turn Tom Griffin's goblet upside down before the upright yet.
Okay, because he just passed away.
Yes.
Boy, only four of you left. That's amazing. But
I'm between 91 and 97 years old.
Okay, well, hey, I'm sure glad you're here, and I'm sure glad you came in, or that we got together for this interview. I thank you so much, David Thatcher. Once again, David, thank you so much. David Thatcher, thank you so much for being with me.